coming up on Economics Explored.
So I think this is a really neat methodology that the Treasury is trying to break down the different influences on the budget to see what's really going on. And what it reveals is that there's this structural problem with the budget.
Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney, broadcasting from Brisbane, Australia. This is episode 164 on structural budget balances. Government budgets around the world were smashed by COVID-19, with countries recording huge deficits and big increases in debt. But the governments of many countries have structural budget deficits. So even as their economies recover, they are still running deficits. In many countries, the fundamental structure of the budget is bad. There is too much spending relative to revenue, even in normal times, not just in recession. For example, the IMF estimates the United States will have a structural or cyclically adjusted government budget deficit of 5 to 7% of GDP over 2023 to 2027. In this episode, we explore how economists can calculate structural budget balances. We consider the different components of budgets, the structural, cyclical, and temporary. We look specifically at what the Australian Treasury does, given that a new Australian budget came out last week. Joining me for the conversation is my adept economics colleague, Arturo Espinosa. Please check out the show notes for relevant links and clarifications, and for details of how you can get in touch with any questions or comments. I'd love to hear from you. Righto, now for my conversation with Arturo on structural budget balances. Thanks to my audio engineer, Josh Krotz, for his assistance in producing this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Arturo, good to be with you again.
Hi, Gene. My pleasure to be here.
Excellent, Arturo. So I thought today we could have a good chat about this concept of a structural budget balance. So we had our federal budget, the Australian government budget, was released last week. So for 22-23, the financial year. And this was because we have a new government. So there was an election in May and there was a change of government. We now have a Labor government. So a more left-wing government than the previous government, which was the Liberal National government, the coalition government. And in Australia, a Liberal government is actually a Conservative government. It's all very confusing. Right, so we had a change of government and there was some improvement in the current year budget balance because of higher commodity prices, which flow through to earnings tax revenue that the federal government pulls in, particularly from the big mining companies. So there was an improvement in that underlying, what they call the underlying cash balance, but the federal government is still running quite significant deficits. So it's still running a deficit of some $37 billion this financial year. The previous government did its budget back in May. I think they were projecting that up around, must have been nearly $80 billion, I can't remember exactly. But it was an improvement on that, but it's still 1.5% of GDP at $37 billion. And then over what they call the forward estimates, which is out to 25-26, we've still got deficits in the range of $40 to $50 billion approximately, and you know, up to 2% of GDP in 24-25. So we've still got significant deficits. And the problem that we're seeing in Australia, and this is similar to in other countries too, is that governments are just spending much more than they're bringing in revenue. I mean, I guess that's what a deficit is, right? I mean, that's but there's a problem that because of politics, because no one wants to pay taxes, politicians don't want to put up taxes, and they want to deliver the goodies. They want to fund a high level of services for the population, and that helps them get elected. And so we've got this problem, this imbalance between what they're spending and what they're bringing in taxes. And this is where I think this structural budget balance concept is of great use. And I just want to talk about that. So does that make sense, Arturo, what we're going to cover today?
Yeah, that makes sense. It also is a very interesting topic related to government debts, yes, and this structural budget, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's always a concept that's fascinated me. So I used to work in the Treasury in the budget policy area, and when I was there, we didn't produce this structural budget balance estimate, and there was a big debate about whether Australia should have one and whether it's feasible to develop one, because as we'll discover, you have to make all sorts of assumptions to generate it. There's a bit of number crunching that goes into it, and you have to make all sorts of assumptions regarding, well, what's the normal state of affairs one way of thinking about this structural budget balance is that it's what the budget would be if you took away the cyclical or cyclical factors. So if you were able to abstract or control for the business cycle, so whether the economy is booming or whether it's slumping, then it gives you the budget balance that you would get in that situation. Because one of the problems with the standard budget balance as a measure of how the government is performing in a fiscal sense is that it is what economists call endogenous. Largely it's determined by the state of the economy. It's determined within the system. It's endogenous. It's not something that the government can totally set exogenously, or it doesn't have full control over it, because your level of taxes depend on the state of the economy and commodity prices in Australia. If the iron ore prices is really high or the coal price is high, then BHP, Rio Tinto, et cetera, the big mining companies, they're earning more profits, and the federal government, it gets a share of that. It gets about 30% of that of their profits. So, that can mean billions of dollars to the budget bottom line. And so that's why we see the budget balance, it moves with the economic cycle. And so a government could be running a deficit, but that could be understandable given the state of the economy. And so the underlying budget is okay. The structural part of the budget is okay. That's not the case with Australia, but I'm just using that as an illustration. So it may be useful. Well, I think it is very useful to adjust for those cyclical factors. And that's what the Australian Treasury has done in what I think is one of the most useful charts in the budget, which is in their statement on the fiscal outlook, chart 320, the structural budget balance. And that really tells a story. It tells a story about how within the federal budget, because of this gap between what government is spending money on and what we're paying in taxes. So if government spending is at a level it must be around 26% of GDP, and revenue is under 24% of GDP, or maybe it's 25 and 23, but it's of that sort of order of magnitude, or those are approximate figures. I'll put the right figures in the show notes. We've got this gap, and this is a permanent gap. It's a structural gap, and this is what this chart shows, of 2% of GDP. And this is baked into the budget. And this is what this structural budget balance chart shows. So what they've done is they've worked out that structural factors are leading to a deficit of about 2% of GDP. Cyclical factors, so the state of the economy, the state of commodity prices, the fact that the iron ore price is super high, the fact that the economy has been booming, what that's doing is that is pushing up, or that's improving the budget balance by, looks like 1.8 or 1.9% if you look at the chart. Mm-hmm. And so what that is telling me, and what that is, this is for the current financial year, 22-23, what it's telling me is that, well, if we didn't have that structural problem in the budget where we're just spending more than we're bringing in, and that's the case in that would be the case in a normal year, in an average year, if we just controlled for the economic cycle, if we didn't have that structural problem, and if we looked at what the strength of the economy is, commodity prices, then the government should be running a budget surplus of nearly 2% of GDP. And in actual fact, it's running a budget deficit of 1.5% of GDP. So there's this big gap, which in a way represents the additional demand that the government is generating in the economy that isn't warranted given the economic circumstances. So the government budget is highly stimulatory to the economy, and that is arguably a problem I think it is a problem. It's contributing to the inflationary situation that we have in the Australian economy at the moment. And likewise, governments around the world that are running large budget deficits, such as the US government, such as the UK government, are contributing to the inflationary situations in those countries. Because if you looked at what the budget should be given the state of the economy, it should be in a lot better state than it is now, than those budgets are now. And that's what this cyclically adjusted budget balance or structural budget balance is approximating. Okay. One of the other fascinating things in that chart, I should note, the Treasury has prepared on the structural budget balance for Australia, is that in 22-23, there's still a sizable impact over 1% of GDP coming from temporary fiscal measures. So these are things that are related to COVID-19, to the pandemic response. So even though, I know that COVID is still around, and apparently we've got another wave coming. The worst part of the pandemic's over, but still there is we do have these temporary fiscal measures occurring. And so what that means is, so that's something that's contributing to the deficit here in Australia. So what that chart's telling us is that, look, the structural problem in the budget is around 2 percentage points or 2% of GDP. The benefit to the budget from the improvement in the economic cycle and higher commodity prices is just under 2% of GDP. So what that would suggest is that would mean we'd have a budget deficit of just a fraction of GDP, like maybe 0.1 or 0.2% of GDP. But then we've got these, actually it might be 0.3 or 0.4, I'll have to check the numbers. They don't put the exact numbers in the charts. So I'm just trying to eyeball, and I'm not wearing my glasses. But then we've got this temporary fiscal measures, which is worsening the budget by over 1% of GDP. And how these all sort of add up is that we end up with a budget deficit in 22-23 of, 1.5%. So I think this is a really neat methodology. The Treasury is trying to break down the different influences on the budget to see what's really going on. And what it reveals is that there's this structural problem with the budget. And, this is something that all treasuries and finance ministers should do, in my opinion. There are some IMF estimates for other countries we'll talk about later. The Australian Treasury seems to be doing a really good job at its estimates, and it's discovered this structural problem, this big hole in the budget. Okay, so does that all make sense, Arturo?
Yeah, that makes sense. That was very clear. Yes, it's incredible how Australia is spending around this, as you mentioned, around 2 or 3% is spending more than what they receive in terms of revenue. But let's explore what are the main components of that structural deficit.
Yes. Well, a big component, or one of the major contributors to it in recent years, has been the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So it's this expansion of the welfare state. Now, I'm not making any judgment about whether that's a good idea or not, yep, because it's very popular and
it's well-intentioned and there are clearly a lot of people out there in need. One of the challenges with it, though, is that it is growing at a very high rate. So it's not the total structural deficit, because it's at the moment I think it's around $30 billion. So it's not just NDIS, it's other things. And then, you know, we've had various tax cuts in the past. There's a stage three tax cut that's programmed in. So there's going to be a tax cut in 2024-25, which aims to get rid of one of the tax brackets and to flatten the progressivity of the tax system, and that's going to cost the budget revenue. So it's a combination of new spending programs and spending programs that are costing more money than were expected.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we've got a rising interest bill at the moment because of higher interest rates. And then people on the left of politics would argue, well, look, the problem is we're just not raising enough in taxation if you're going to spend this. And that's one legitimate perspective. If the government is going to spend this much on a permanent basis, mm-hmm. if we are committed to an NDIS, a National Disability Insurance Scheme, then we would have to have higher taxes to make the budget sustainable in the long term. I mean, personally, I'd prefer that we'd have lower taxes. We would get spending under control. But look, if we can't get spending under control, then we may have to put up with that. Because ultimately, we do need a sustainable budget. We've got to keep that debt to GDP ratio under control. At the moment, the projections are that for Australia, it's not looking catastrophic yet, luckily. I mean, it's on the current budget projections, it's going to get up to around 48% of GDP. So it's going to plateau around that by the, 2032, 2033. There's another chart where they're projecting that in how that's going to perform. So this is the debt to GDP, which is one of the critical ratios that commentators, economists, ratings agencies like S&P and Fitch and Moody's, what they look at. And, I mean, Australia's lucky. We started off with we started off with no debt to begin with in 2008. We had negative net debt and we only had $50 billion of bonds on issue. So we're in a good position to start with. So we're only going to get up to about 50% of GDP at the moment, compared with you look at the States, which is the US, it's over. We had a look the other day, didn't we? I mean, it's up 120 to 130% of GDP insane, or something. Yes. Yeah, it's very high if you look at projections for actual data and projections for the US. So we're nowhere near that. What's happening is that the outlook is worsening. So if you look at that Treasury chart and the budget, compared with where we were back in May or back in April when the government released its last budget, that's right before the election, and then the Treasury put out the pre-election economic and fiscal outlook, instead of the gross debt to GDP ratio peaking around 24, 25 and then falling as the economy grows and the debt doesn't grow as fast, which was what they were previously forecasting back in April, and they had the gross debt to GDP ratio going to 40%. Instead, it's going to continue to grow over this decade and then start to flatten out around 2032 to 33 at around 48%. And I mean, who knows, that could get worse. I mean, it so much depends on what happens with interest rates. And a big part of this change, why things are worse now than they were back in April, well, one, it's because this NDIS is growing, the cost of that is growing faster than expected, and also because of the higher interest burden. I think that's really shocked people. And this is something I've been calling out for a while, I've been identifying for a while, that this is, as interest rates rise, that's going to have a big impact on the budget, because we've got so much
debt already. Not as much as other countries, but still more than we've had in the past. So, well, in the last few decades. Okay. So does that answer your question, Arturo? You were asking about where's it come from and,
yes.
Yeah, where's that structural deficit come from? And, look, it's a variety of things.
Yes.
It's just our unwillingness to bear the taxes. It's either you can either look at it as our unwillingness to pay the taxes that we need to fund the level of services. That's one perspective. That's the perspective of people like the Australia Institute. They would argue that all these things we're spending money on, so a left-wing perspective. I'm not making any judgments at the moment about, I mean, I've got my own personal judgment, but I'll just present both sides of the story. They would argue we're not raising enough revenue, and then the people on the other side, they like the IPA or whoever, the right, they would argue, well, we're actually spending too much relative to what we're paying in taxes. The level of taxation is fine or should be cut even further. Let's cut expenditure. And the government itself is very conscious. It doesn't want to raise taxes, right, because raising taxes is politically unpopular. No one wants to pay any more tax. So it looks like the government itself recognises that it will have to cut spending. I mean, maybe it'll try and tweak some tax policy settings or cut some tax concessions. Jim Chalmers, the treasurer here, he's talking about taking a forensic approach to tax concessions. There was a story in The Australian today, so it looks like they're going to have a look at some of those tax concessions. So who knows, they could look at tax concessions for superannuation and they could look at our concessional taxation of capital gains, things like that. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But look, NDIS is the one that they really need to look at because it's just growing at a very high rate. So let me try to illustrate that with some figures. So last week's federal budget, so I'm quoting from a report in The Australian today, revealed the NDIS, which will cost the federal and state governments $35.5 billion this financial year, is on track to hit $52 billion by 2025-26, dwarfing the costs of both Medicare and aged care. So long-term Treasury forecasts suggest the federal government's contribution to the scheme will grow by almost 14% a year for the next decade, with total scheme costs approaching $100 billion by 2032-33. It became operational in 2013. It currently has 555,000 participants. Its annual financial sustainability report suggests numbers will reach almost 860,000 by 2030. More young people with diagnoses of autism and psychosocial disorders are entering the scheme. Almost a third of current participants have an autism diagnosis and 4 in 10 are aged 14 and under. So this is an illustration of one of the challenges of public services, I think, because there is a lot of need out there. There are a lot of people who are doing it tough, or there's a lot of need in the community. And as soon as government gets involved, there are a lot of pressures on government to expand the level of service, to increase the level of service. This is a great challenge for government. I remember when I was in workplace health and safety here in Queensland, Jim, it's nearly 20 years ago now, I remember the policy discussions around the need to look after people who were catastrophically injured. This NDIS has come out of a need to at least look after people who fell through the cracks of the previous system. What happened years ago was if you were catastrophically injured, say you had a diving accident and it was recreational diving, you weren't covered by any insurance, okay? It wasn't a motor vehicle accident. It wasn't a workplace accident. And there would be very high costs of care if you were made quadriplegic, for example, but there's no insurance to cover you. And so there was this concern that there were these people who are missing out. And so there's clearly some sort of – there was a need definitely to do something to help those people out. And this whole NDIS, from what I can tell, grew out of that conversation that was occurring around the early 2000s, because I remember being part of the conversation at the Queensland government level and some of the policy development there. And then it came out of this 2008, the 2020 summit that Kevin Rudd organised, this ideas fest that they had in, or talk fest that they had at Parliament House. And they invited 1,000 of the best and brightest from around Australia. And this was one of the ideas that was advanced at the summit and one of the ones that was progressed. And then the Gillard government introduced it, I think, in 2013. And look, it's a really valid thing. There's certainly cases, people that needed assistance. The problem is, where do you draw the line? And this is a problem that governments often have. And here the line has become the circle has expanded even more. And, I mean, people, families with autism and with developmental delay certainly need assistance. And I'm on the board of a not-for-profit that advocates for families where a child has a developmental delay. So I fully understand the concerns and the need. The issue is that it is... there's a big cost to the budget from having this expansive definition. And the government is currently, we'll have to wait and see what it does about it all.
Okay, we'll take a short break here for a word from our sponsor.
If you need to crunch the numbers, then get in touch with Adept Economics. We offer you frank and fearless economic analysis and advice. We can help you with funding submissions, cost-benefit analysis studies, and economic modelling of all sorts. Our head office is in Brisbane, Australia, but we work all over the world. You can get in touch via our website, www.adepteconomics.com.au. We'd love to hear from you.
Now back to the show.
So, any questions or any thoughts on that, Arturo?
No, at the moment.
All good. So, yeah, that's essentially where we've got this structural budget balance problem coming from Australia. And I thought it might be good just to go over quickly what the different sources or the different ways that they adjust for the state of the economy. And what it comes down to is coming up with estimates of how the economy would have performed, what it would do in the absence of a business cycle. So you have to work out what a trend level of GDP is. So if you think about macroeconomics, one way of thinking about how the economy evolves over time is a cycle and trend. There's the economy over time. We know that the economy expands, so the economy today is much larger than it was 10 years ago. It's much larger than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So over time it grows. There's trend growth. Yes. It's on an upward trajectory, but it will cycle around that trend. So you can have periods where you're well above that trend when the economy is booming, and then you can have periods when you're well below, you're in a recession, for example. And so what these structural budget balance estimates, what they do is they're based on an estimate of what that trend level of GDP would be. And so what they will do, what the Treasury will do, is they will look at, well, what's the underlying population growing at? What's productivity on average growing at? And are there any trends in labour force participation that we need to take into account? And there's this supply side model underpinning these trend GDP estimates, or these what you would expect in the absence of a business cycle. And so that's one of the core parts of it. They're trying to control for the business cycle, and then they also have to control for commodity prices. So they'll look at, well, how much higher than we'd normally are commodity prices, the iron ore price, the coal price, how much higher are they than we'd normally expect them to be? And let's discount that. Let's assume that they're not so high. And so the Treasury will have these parameters. They'll have these sensitivities of different of these revenue items of income tax, of company income tax, to different commodity prices. They'll have an estimate of how sensitive the unemployment benefits that are paid are to the state of the economy, to where GDP is relative to its trend. And I think that's the one item that the Treasury adjusts. So it tweaks, it adjusts revenue. On the revenue side, it adjusts the income tax and company tax and I think capital gains tax, if I remember correctly. On the expenditure side, it just adjusts unemployment benefits. We know that unemployment benefit payments are going to be higher if the economy is in recession, lower if it's booming. And so there's an adjustment that's made there. And there's a whole bunch of assumptions that go into these estimates. Does that all make sense, Arturo?
Yes, it's clear, Jean.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll put a link in the show notes to a paper estimating the structural budget balance of the Australian government that was by three of my old colleagues, so Tony McDonald, Yong Hong Yang, who I don't know, Blake Ford and David Steffen. So I worked with Tony, Blake and David, so all good people. So that's a great paper. I'll link to that in the show notes. And I've noticed that the IMF also produces some estimates of these structural budget balances, although they use the other name for them, cyclically adjusted balance. And you can find these at the back of what's called the IMF Fiscal Monitor. And I'm looking at the one from October 2022, so check that out. There's a whole range of interesting estimates there. So if, for example, you look at table A3 for advanced economies, general government cyclically adjusted balance 2013 to 2027, so it's got historical data, it's got forecasts in it. For Australia, they've got their own estimates of what the structural budget deficit is. They've got estimates that go from around, 3.5% in 2022, so that's a calendar year, 3.1% deficit in 23, 24, 2.6%, and it gets down to about 0.7% a deficit in 2027. So not as bad as the Australian Treasury's estimates, which have the structural deficit maintaining at around 2%. There are reasons why the IMF figures are different from the Australian government's, because the IMF doesn't take into account as many factors. It's on a calendar year basis. The Treasury, I think in one of its papers, it goes through why its estimates are different from, say, the IMF or the OECD. I think for Australia, the Treasury are probably doing a better job at it, just because the IMF and the other agency, international agencies, they have to do it for all the countries and they're not experts in any particular country. I think the Australian Treasury's estimates are probably better for getting a sense of the structural problem in the budget. The Treasury's got access to much better info, much better data on Australia than the IMF, or it's got much better insights, I should say, into what's going on, and its model for the structural budget balance for Australia is much more precise. It goes into more detail than the IMF. So all I'm saying is I think the Australian Treasury numbers are better than what the IMF is estimating there, and I tend to agree that there is that structural budget balance of 2% of GDP, which is a challenge for this current government. And will probably be a challenge for future governments. And it's going to require either large cuts in spending, so getting the NDIS under control, which is going to be hugely unpopular because it's very popular program and well-intentioned. I know people are benefiting from it. And, it's giving people a sense of dignity and improving people's quality of life. So, look, who knows? I mean, this government, because it's a government from the sort of left wing, I mean, it's not as left as some other governments you'd see around the world. It's not left if you think about what left-wing governments are in South America, for example. But it's not, it it's going to find it difficult because it is more left-wing than right-wing, say the Liberal National Government. It's going to find it difficult to cut something like NDIS or cut welfare benefits, and hence maybe it does have to look at some tax measures. Maybe it does have to cut tax concessions heavily. Maybe it does have to adjust that stage three tax cut that's programmed in. Maybe not give as much of much. Maybe not have such a big tax cut. We'll have to wait and see. Okay. Anything else, Arturo, that we should cover before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I wanted to highlight that it should be a good discussion, a good topic to see which of those programs, social programs, are working good in terms of indicators, so in terms of the results on population, in order to see if there is any problem there. But because we know that not all the things are, or all the social programs are working well, perhaps that should be a good topic to discuss, to be discussed in other episodes.
Yeah. Look, I think you're right there. And what this is highlighting, I think, Arturo, is, yes, the need to really delve into whether these programs are working or not, because we've got these programs that are well-intentioned, that governments, they hope to do some good, to achieve outcomes, but how do we know that they are actually achieving outcomes, or they're doing it in the most cost-effective way? And that's why something like this evaluator general concept could be so valuable. This is an idea that the first person I remember proposing it's Nicholas Gruen. So Nick's been on the show before, well-known Australian economist, CEO of Lateral Economics. I do some work with Nick from time to time. And, he's been involved in public policy for decades. He was involved with the button car plan back in the 80s. He was involved with – he worked for the treasurer in the 90s, very lateral thinker. And he came up with this idea of the evaluator general, which would have a brief of going across the Australian government and figuring out which programs work, which don't. Are there – other ways we can do things, other innovative ways we can do things to solve problems. And it looks like this government is going to go ahead with some sort of evaluator general. So Jim Chalmers has pledged to put in place an effective and rigorous evaluator general, a new office based within Treasury and flagged by Labor before the 2019 election, which could work with other departments to assess the effectiveness of government programs. Okay, great stuff. So this is in an article by Joe Kelly in The Australian. I'll put a link in the show notes that I was quoting from there. I think one of the issues Nick has with that proposal, though, is that it's located within the Treasury. I think he would prefer that it has its own life. It's outside of Treasury. It's a statutory authority. It has some degree of independence granted by the Parliament. I don't think Nick's actually, I can't speak for him. I should have him on the show to talk about that. But I'm guessing he probably thinks that that's not exactly what we need. But look, I should let him speak about that in the future. So that's the evaluator general. So I think that's the sort of thing you're driving at, is it, Arturo? Mm-hmm. That because we need to evaluate these programs. Exactly.
Yeah.
The evaluator general is one way of
the performance doing of that. The program, yes.
Exactly. So one thing I thought I should cover before we wrap up is just what happened with the UK earlier. When was it? Was it last month? Or remember they had their mini budget? Maybe it was in September now. They had the mini budget. Liz Truss, the new PM, no longer PM, shortest reigning PM in British history.
Yes.
And the Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, I think it was. And they released that mini budget with a big tax cut. And the markets just absolutely went nuts. The pound crashed. We had yields on UK bonds spike because everyone there, and this is a, this is the recognition that there was a structural problem already with the UK budget. The UK couldn't afford to have a tax cutter who was going to spend, go on spending what it was spending. And it's just quite extraordinary. The way that the Institute of Fiscal Studies described it, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes. I think it's a great note and it's a really good take on it. The way they described that mini budget, which has been reversed because, you know, the current, there's a recognition that it was unsustainable. So we've got a new PM now and a new Chancellor, and they've reversed that. I think Liz Truss had even reversed it, and she'd sacked her Chancellor. But okay, so it's gone. But for a short time, it was in place, and the markets absolutely freaked out. And this is the IFS take, which I think is great, which was made at the time. The Chancellor announced the biggest package of tax cuts in 50 years without even a semblance of an effort to make the public finance numbers add up. I mean, that is just brutal. It goes to show just how important it is to actually care about this stuff. And, I mean, I've been saying this for years. I used to work in Treasury in the budget area, and I know how important it is to get this stuff right and not to go and do silly things. And so I understand where IFS is coming from, and I understand why the markets really just hated that mini budget. And there's a great chart in that IFS analysis which showed that if you look at what was happening to the national debt or the UK public debt, if you compare that mini budget, what would happen with the mini budget with what was expected before. So instead of the debt as a percent of national income staying in the range from 80 to 85% of GDP, going down gradually over the next 5 years from around 85 to 80, instead it was going to end up going from a bit under 85% to nearly 95%. Whoa. So it's just really bad policy. So understandably, that mini budget was absolutely, I mean, the markets just reacted very badly and essentially brought down the Prime Minister and the Chancellor it was just very irresponsible fiscal policy. And that's what we've always got to guard against. Now, we're not there yet in Australia. Because we started off in such a good position, our debt to GDP is still relatively low compared with other countries. We've got a bit of room still. We've got time. We've got time to turn it around, but we've got to start doing something, because we just can't be in a situation where we keep accumulating debt. And we know there'll be another crisis of some kind. There'll be a downturn. Hopefully we don't have another pandemic, but there's going to be another crisis. There'll be a period when we end up adding lots of debt in a short period of time or a few years, and that will mean a higher interest burden. These projections of our debt to GDP starting to flatten out around 2032, 33 at 48% of GDP, okay, that could give us some comfort, but we just don't know what's coming down the track. My worry is that interest rates could go higher. There could be another downturn or a crisis, and then we add more debt on, and then that gross debt to GDP, instead of flattening out, it goes on an upward trajectory. That's a risk I worry about, and why it's so important to get the budget under control. Okay. Final thoughts, Arturo?
No. Thank you for all your explanation, Gene.
Very good. Well, it's been great chatting with you, Arturo, and I look forward to chatting again. And if you're listening in the audience and you want to look at any of these articles I've mentioned, I'll put links in the show notes. Please get in touch with any questions or comments. Let me know whether you agree or disagree. Let me know if there are things you want to know more about, and I'll do my best to cover them in a future episode. So thanks for listening. And Arturo, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Gene. Bye.
Okay, that's the end of this episode of Economics Explored. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your family and friends and leave a comment or give us a rating on your podcast app.
If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, you can feel free to send them to contact@economicsexplored.com and we'll aim to address them in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Until next week, goodbye.